While I continued teaching politics and also did a little law work, Hillary was settling into life in Fayetteville. I could tell she really liked being there, maybe even enough to stay. She taught criminal law and trial advocacy and oversaw both the legal aid clinic and the students who did work for prison inmates. Some of the crusty old lawyers and judges and a few of the students didn't know what to make of her at first, but eventually she won them over. In the summer, I taught both semesters of summer school to earn some extra money and had a good time hanging around Fayetteville with Hillary and our friends. One day, I drove her to the airport for a trip back east. As we were driving down California Drive, we passed a beautiful little jagged brick house, set back on a rise with a stone wall bracing up the front yard. There was a for sale sign in the yard. She remarked on how pretty the place was. After I dropped her off, I checked the house out. It was a one-story structure of about 1,100 square feet, with a bedroom, a bathroom, a kitchen with a breakfast room attached, a small dining room, and a gorgeous living room that had a beam ceiling half again as high as the others in the house, a good-looking offset fireplace, and a big bay window. There was also a large screened-in porch that could double as a guest bedroom most of the year. The house had no air conditioning, but the big attic fan did a good job. The price was $20,500. I bought the house with a $3,000 down payment, big enough to get the monthly mortgage payments down to $174. I moved what little furniture I had into my new house and bought enough other things so that the place wasn't totally bare. When Hillary came back from her trip, I said, "Remember that little house you like so much? I bought it. You have to marry me now because I can't live there alone." I took her to see the house. It still needed a lot of work, but my rash move did the trick. Although she had never even told me she was prepared to stay in Arkansas, she finally said yes. On October the 11th, 1975, we were married in the big living room of the little house at 930 California Drive. Probably more has been written or said about our marriage than about any other in America. I've always been amazed at the people who felt free to analyze, criticize, and pontificate about it. After being married for nearly 30 years and observing my friends' experiences with separations, reconciliations, and divorces, I've learned that marriage, with all its magic and misery, all its contentments and disappointments, remains a mystery, not easy for those in it to understand, and largely inaccessible to outsiders. On October the 11th, 1975, I didn't know any of that. All I knew then was that I loved Hillary, the life, work, and friends we now had in common, and the promise of what we could do together. I was proud of her, too, and thrilled to be in a relationship that might not ever be perfect, but would certainly never be boring. In December, I had another political decision to make. Many of my supporters wanted me to run for Congress again. They wanted a rematch. I thought Congressman Hammersmith would be harder to beat this time. More important, I'd lost my desire to go to Washington. I wanted to stay in Arkansas. And I was getting more interested in state government, thanks in part to the opportunity Attorney General Jim Guy Tucker had given me to write a brief to the U.S. Supreme Court on behalf of our state in an antitrust case involving the setting of interest rates on credit cards. Jim Guy was running for Congress, so the Attorney General's job would be open, and it had a lot of appeal for me. I took a leave from law school and got to work. I had two opponents in the Democratic primary, George Jernigan, the Secretary of State, and Clarence Cash, who was head of the Consumer Protection Division in Jim Guy Tucker's office. Both were articulate and not much older than I. Jernigan seemed to be the more formidable of the two, with a lot of friends among Governor Pryor's organization, several county courthouses, and conservatives across the state. Strangely, no Republicans filed, the only time I ever ran without opposition in the general election. As I traveled the state, I found I had to contend with the rise of a new political force, the Moral Majority, founded by the Reverend Jerry Falwell, a conservative Baptist minister from Virginia who had won a large television following and was using it to build a national organization committed to Christian fundamentalism and right-wing politics. In any part of the state, I might find myself shaking hands with someone who would ask if I was a Christian. When I said yes, I would be asked if I was a born-again Christian. When I said yes, there would be several more questions, apparently supplied by Falwell's organization. Once, when I was campaigning in Conway, about 30 miles east of Little Rock, I was in the county clerk's office, where absentee ballots are cast. One of the women who worked there started in on me with the questions. Apparently, I gave the wrong answer to one of them, and before I left the courthouse, She had cost me 4 absentee votes. I didn't know what to do. I wasn't about to answer a question about religion falsely, but I didn't want to keep losing votes. I called Senator Dale Bumpers, a good liberal Methodist, for advice. "Oh, I get that all the time," he said, "but I never let them get past the first question. When they ask me if I'm a Christian, I say, 'I sure hope so, and I've always tried to be. But I really think that's a question only God can judge.' That usually shuts them up." After Bumpers finished, I laughed and told him now I knew why he was a senator and I was just a candidate for attorney general. And for the rest of the campaign, I used his answer. In the end, I took the primary, winning more than 55% of the total vote and carrying 69 of the 75 counties, thanks to a big vote in South Arkansas, where I had lots of relatives and good friends, and a whopping 74% in the 3rd Congressional District. All the people who'd worked so hard for me in 1974 were finally rewarded. Since I didn't have an opponent in the general election, I agreed to run Jimmy Carter's campaign in Arkansas, which ended in a landslide victory. When I moved into the Attorney General's office, there was a serious backlog of opinions and other work. My staff and I often worked until midnight to catch up, and in the process we developed a great rapport and had a terrific time. On Fridays, when the legislature wasn't in session, I allowed casual dress and encouraged everyone to go for a long lunch at a nearby haunt that had first-rate hamburgers, pinball machines, and a shuffleboard game. The old unpainted shack also had a big canoe on the roof and an ominous name, the Whitewater Tavern. The growing strength of the moral majority and like-minded groups gave rise to some legislation that many moderate and progressive legislators didn't want to pass, but didn't want to be on record as voting against. The obvious tactic was to get the Attorney General to say the bill was unconstitutional. This was an example of another of Clinton's laws of politics. If someone can shift the heat from himself to you, he'll do it every time. The funniest bills were offered by Representative Arlo Tyre of Pocahontas in northeast Arkansas. Arlo was a decent man who wanted to stay one step ahead of the moral majority. He introduced a bill to make it illegal to show X-rated movies anywhere in Arkansas, even to adults. I was asked whether the bill was an unconstitutional restriction on the freedom of speech. I could just imagine the headlines. Attorney General comes out for dirty movies. I called Bob Dudley, a district judge from Arlo's hometown, to find out why he'd introduced the bill. "Do you have a lot of X-rated movies up there?" I asked. Dudley, who was a real wit, said, "No, we don't have any movie theaters at all. He's just jealous of the rest of you getting to see all that stuff." As soon as the movie bill died, Arlo came up with another gem. A $1,500-a-year tax on every couple in Arkansas who live together without benefit of wedlock. The headline alarm bell went off in my brain again. I went to see Representative Tyre on this one. "Arlo," I asked, "how long do a man and woman have to cohabit to pay this tax? A year, a month, a weekend?" "You know, I hadn't thought about that," he replied. "And what about enforcement?" I went on. "Are you and I going to get baseball bats and knock down doors to see who's doing what with whom?" Arlo shrugged and said, "I hadn't thought about that either. Maybe I better pull that bill down." I walked back to my office relieved to have dodged another bullet. Toward the end of 1977, the political talk started again. Senator McClellan had announced his retirement after almost 35 years in the Senate, setting the stage for an epic battle to be his successor. Governor Pryor, who'd come close to defeating McClellan 6 years earlier, was going to run. So were Jim Guy Tucker and the congressman from the 4th District in South Arkansas, Ray Thornton, who had achieved prominence as a member of the House Judiciary Committee during the Nixon impeachment proceedings. I also received some encouragement to run for the Senate, but by then I preferred state government and executive as opposed to legislative work, and I loved living in Arkansas. So I decided to run for governor. On primary election day, I got 60% of the vote and carried 71 of the 75 counties. In the fall campaign, my opponent was a cattleman and the chairman of the state Republican Party, Lynn Lowe. The race was uneventful except for the press conference on the steps of the Capitol, in which his campaign accused me of being a draft dodger. I referred them to Colonel Holmes, and I won the election with 63% of the vote, carrying 69 of the 75 counties. At 32, I was the governor-elect of Arkansas, with 2 months to assemble a staff, put together a legislative program, and wrap up my work as Attorney General.